Hi, welcome to the podcast. I am Joe Poznanski, senior writer at Sports on Earth. Very fortunate this week to have with us ESPN senior writer Keith Law. You might remember, I don't know if Keith will remember, the last time I had Keith on the podcast, it was the only live podcast that I've ever done, and in a wise move that just features my technology skills, I had him sitting like 6 miles away from the microphone, so it basically just sounds like me talking, and then like in the background you could hear like just the murmurs of Keith. You have to sort of guess. But Keith, thanks so much for joining me in a way where I think we can actually hear you.
I'll make sure to shout today.
make sure to just, you know, look, as you well know, the odds of this being recorded, very slim. So
that's right. It's a good thing I like talking to you. Otherwise, this would just be a waste of time.
Complete waste of time. So either way, we'll have a good time with it. And we are actually, this is a very, very rare podcast moment. We're talking baseball, and for once, there's almost no chance that this thing is going to be outdated by the time I put it on, because that we are talking on a Monday, and World Series ended yesterday, sweep by the Giants or the Tigers, and so that's it. Baseball's over. It's done.
Yeah.
It's completely done. All right, so let's start with the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
Dreadful, right? Dreadful.
Yeah. I'm glad you said that, because I was going to ask you, like, if you're not a fan of the Giants, it was a terrible World Series to watch.
Yeah.
We had virtually no drama. Last night, we had some drama. We had some lead changes. We still didn't have a lot of opportunities until, once it was 3-3, it's not like there were a ton of missed opportunities after that. And once it got to extra innings, really, once it got to the bullpen, I was sitting there, I could turn this off and watch Homeland at this point. You know the Giants are going to win now.
Yeah.
It was disappointing, and it left, you know, I felt like, it's funny, we're not doing the Baseball Today podcast. We may not be doing it at all this week because of the hurricane. I'm thinking, that's not the worst thing in the world, because there's not a whole lot to break down. What? We didn't have drama. We didn't have huge managerial decisions. The Giants just kind of cleaned Detroit's clocks.
Yeah, they really did. I mean, and look, and I love that Giants team. I love the way San Francisco has embraced baseball. I mean, it's it's a very, very cool thing.
Yep.
But I was sitting there trying to think of, like, okay, well, what was the dramatic moment or dramatic moments of this series? And honestly, I came up with, like, Prince Fielder trying to score from, you know, that was kind of it. And by dramatic, I mean hilarious, by the way.
Yeah, right. That's exactly right.
Completely hysterically funny. But that was it. I mean, there was really, you know, last year's World Series was just chock full of bullpen
amazing
phones and managerial fiascos and you know, huge hits and David Freese and Josh Hamilton. I mean, it was great. And we had so much of that in the first round of the playoffs this year, which were awesome. But
The NLCS too.
We did it, but even the NLCS, I would argue, the games themselves individually were not very good.
Yeah, you know what? Like, once the Giants kind of flipped the switch, it was sort of, wait, where'd the Cardinals go?
Yeah,
like, did they think it was three? They thought this was a 5-game series, and they left. Well, that's kind of how I felt like Detroit looked in the World Series too. Because now you're hearing it's, oh, there was the rust. They had too much time off. Look, that's possible. But having watched the games, I didn't feel like they looked rusty.
No.
I felt like they looked unprepared. Like, they were surprised at what was coming at them. I'm really talking about the hitters, because actually, other than Verlander, Detroit's starting pitching was not a problem.
Not at all.
It was Detroit's lineup, and there was the Quinton Berry problem, or you could just call it the number two hitter problem, which is that time and again, Miguel Cabrera was left standing in the on-deck circle at the end of an inning. You could argue the Berry double play was one of those other dramatic moments.
Yes.
This is exactly what San Francisco needed. And Miguel Cabrera is, I know he didn't have a huge World Series, but still, that's the guy you want up at the plate. And the Tigers kept finding themselves unable to get him to the plate. But beyond the lineup construction issue, it was just, you're watching them and thinking, did they not get the advance reports? Did they not watch the Giants, at least at the end of the NLCS? It seemed like their timing was off, but they were constantly surprised by pitches that I thought, other than Bumgarner, I didn't think the Giants starters looked dominant. These are guys who can be dominant, especially Kane. Kane did not look dominant last night. Vogelsong did not look dominant. He was dominant against the Cardinals. He got away with some stuff in his start against Detroit, I thought. And to me, then you've got to start. You don't want to take too much credit away from the pitchers, but you've also got to start looking at the hitters and saying, hey, you had some opportunities and you failed to execute. What's the cause of that?
I thought that was the whole series. I mean, I thought even the Giants missed a lot of hittable pitches. I just didn't think it was – I mean, it's – I don't know if that's the tension, it's the weather. You know, it's funny because a lot of people are talking about the layoff. I don't want this to sound wrong. I don't buy that at all. And maybe there is something to that, and you know, you want to play the next day and all that. But to me, that was a team that really could use – the days off. I mean, it got them Verlander in game one, a completely, you know, rested Verlander. It got an extra day of shoulder rest for Max Scherzer. I didn't think the layoff hurt them at all, and they didn't play, like you said, they didn't play sloppy. It wasn't like they just, I mean, the last time they were in the World Series, you could have said, the layoff.
Remember the you know, just like, all right, pitcher fielding practice tomorrow.
Exactly. Yeah. Nobody.
It wasn't like that.
No.
Their defense got exposed. I mean, that's the one thing we haven't mentioned, too, is that the Giants sort of, you know, I joked on the Baseball Today podcast, you know, the Giants' strategy was basically hit it to the fat guy and run. And, you know, the left side of that, Peralta's fine, but it's really Cabrera and Young. If you could get the ball in that direction, good things were probably going to happen for you. And really, the Tigers. Austin Jackson's a good defender in center. I actually think Peralta's probably a little better than we think he is. He doesn't look great over there, but actually the numbers have been fairly positive on him. There's a lot of below-average defense going on that Tigers on the field for the Tigers, and the Giants do put the ball in play a lot, and they managed to do that especially earlier in the series and sort of let the Tigers make things happen for the Giants. But again, to your point, that's not sloppiness. That's just who the Tigers are. Right. You could have given them a month off, or you could have given them a few hours off. That's basically what they were going to look like on defense.
Well, that is, defensively, that's who they are. And that was a decision they made by putting Cabrera at third and having, you know, Fielder at first. But one thing that really, you know, first of all credit to the Giants. I mean, that team.
They executed.
They totally executed. And they executed, you know, down 2-0 to the Reds. From that point on, they were terrific. I mean, they really, really were terrific. And Vogelsong, what a great story. And Barry.
His start against the Cardinals would probably be my favorite single starting pitching performance of this postseason. The second start when he was Greg Maddux for a night.
Amazing.
Because I just love guys like the guys who can do that, where it's like, I'm going to put a chopstick here on the two edges of the plate vertically, and you can just knock them over one by one. He had one of those outings. And I mean, when I go to a game, I want to see a pitcher do that because it gets me out of the park sooner. But also, it's just incredibly fun to watch a guy who's at the top of his craft for that particular day. Vogelsong may never have another day like that in his career, but he will always have that incredible outing.
Oh, it was incredible. And then Barry Zito. What do you say at this point?
I know. I mean, it almost if you're in the Giants front office, you've got to be sitting there. I mean, obviously you're hungover right now, which is fine. But then you're thinking, you know, what do I do with these guys next year? Barry Zito looks like a completely different animal.
Yes.
Meanwhile, we put Tim Lincecum in the pen, and he's a different animal. I mean, he was, I think, the worst qualifying starter in the NL in a couple of the advanced metrics this year. Now you put him in the pen, and he looks like the old Lincecum. I mean, in terms of his ability to come in and just dominate. And I've often told the story of, you know, when I saw Lincecum as an amateur, I saw him start once and I saw him relieve once, because he would pick, like, he'd start on a Friday for UW and then come in and close on Sunday. And I saw him on the Cape, and as a starter, he was two pitches, strictly fastball, curveball. And after about 70, 75 pitches, his delivery started to come apart. It would just break down just enough that the fastball would drift up, and you could see his command wobble, whereas he could come in out of the pen, and it was 95, 97, and he would just he could have told guys what was coming. They couldn't sniff him because he didn't have to face anybody twice. But he had such a rubber arm, he could go multiple innings. When he came out of the draft, I said, that's what I think he is. Not a starter, but a guy who could be like the old Goose Gossage, 110 innings out of the pen. The Giants could do that next year. It would take tremendous stones to do it, and I'm not going to criticize them if they don't, but What an opportunity for them. What a challenge for them now to figure, we've got all these great pieces. How do we put these guys together so we can maybe do this again, get back to the World Series in 2013?
Yeah, and Lincecum looked reborn in that pen. I mean, not just his performance. I mean, there was a different spark to the way he the way he, you know, pitched. I mean, it was just, he clearly had a confidence again. Zito, to me, was the amazing one. There were times where I was watching Zito, and obviously the curveball's different, but I'm like, this is Jamie Moyer. This guy can be Jamie Moyer for the next 10 years because it's like he figured it out. It's like he figured out I'm left-handed, and, you know, I mean, his changeup is still, you know.
That's been his pitch for a while.
And that's really interesting. And he wasn't really all that good this year for them.
No.
But he won a lot of games, and he pitched a lot of innings for them. And then, I mean, it was pretty staggering. You know, you get five or six good innings out of him, suddenly that's a pretty valuable pitcher.
If you want to go back over the last 2 to 3 years, I mean, this is strictly hindsight, because I think as it was going on, nobody would have looked at it and looked forward and said, hey, he might be morphing into Jamie Moyer. But you can look back over the last couple of years. He's had these 5 to 8 start stretches where he kind of looked like it.
Yes.
He's walking fewer guys. He's missing just enough bats. He's getting a little bit lucky. But, you know, there's such a fine line that guys like that walk. And the biggest thing is just to be able to throw more strikes. And some of that's a confidence issue. And so, you know, sometimes it's mechanical. I don't think that's the case with Zito. If he can be comfortable with sort of this is what I am now, I'm going to pitch in the low 80s a lot of the time, but it's a lot of changeups. He has a better curveball, certainly a prettier curveball than Moyer had. And just recognize, I'm going to pitch backwards. I'm going to throw a ton of strikes. I'm going to trust my defense because the Giants have morphed into a better defensive club than the one he originally came to. It's been there on and off, but he's never been able to sustain it for even half a season. You just wonder, we're seeing, I feel like that Barry Zito showed up a little more this year than he did either of the past 2 years.
Absolutely.
Maybe next year he shows up 20 times. We could be getting there with him, which would be pretty amazing, actually, because that's been, I mean, we've always included that in the discussion of worst contracts ever.
No,
what if he walks out of it and gets another 3-year deal because he's a new guy?
Yeah, well, I mean, it can happen. I really believe that can happen, and he looked a lot like that guy. And I think you make a great point about just, you know, when you were as good as he was when he first came in 2001, 2002 with the A's, I think you do build a mindset. It wasn't like, I mean, he was always doing it with his curveball anyway and his fastball, and he did walk a bunch of guys. He was he was a swing and miss kind of guy. But he always had that with him. And like I said, that changeup, there are times that changeup is really good now. I mean, and that's that to me is fascinating. I mean, that's a fascinating story, the fact that the guy not only was left off of the World Series roster, the playoff postseason roster,
that's right,
2 years ago. He had to be. He was so bad.
Oh, he was terrible.
They had no choice. And now the guy started game one, did exactly what you want him to do. And I think he's becoming an integral part of that team. And you're right. If he shows up 20 times next year where he throws 6 innings, gives up 2 runs, like I said, they have something.
Yeah, and he's durable. I mean, that's the one thing he's always had going for him is, I mean, he was 200 innings a year whenever he was with the A's. The only reason he hasn't really been that with the Giants, it's just he hasn't pitched well enough to get there. But he's taken the ball every fifth day. Outside of part of 2011, he's been extremely dirty. This year was 184 innings. Outside of 2011, that was the second lowest total of his career. I mean, that's certainly something he can take forward into free agency after next year, assuming that he's just better enough.
Yes.
In 2013. It doesn't have to be a star. I mean, I'm doing my free agent rankings now. Let me tell you, get down to the 30s or so. The Barry Zito we just saw would fit in just fine on my ranking.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Look, and couldn't be happier for the guy. I mean, the guy himself is a great guy, and he's been through a lot. You know, I mean, you could say he's been well compensated for going through a lot, and he has.
Yeah.
You know what matters to him, or at least what seems to matter to him, and I was obviously a lot of people. We were thrilled for him, and it'd be great to have him back. Is there a guy more... I'll use it. I always thought the most fun guy to watch when he was like really on was Vlad Guerrero, because he would just swing at anything and he'd hit balls over his head. Isn't Pablo Sandoval, when he's on, a little bit like that?
Oh yeah, absolutely.
He's a blast.
Yeah, he is. Yes, and it, I mean, he's got that enthusiasm, too, that you're just like the photo of him handing the bat to the Hall of Fame guy and they're both grinning at the camera. It's like somebody gets Sandoval his own TV show. Like, this guy's phenomenal. I even said on Twitter, too, you know, it's, after every World Series, there's usually sort of that one player on the winning team who gets plucked for some commercial endorsements or whatever. Like, he's the guy. Now, I understand it's nearly always an American-born player, but he should be the guy because of his personality. It's him and Romo. They were the sort of the two personalities to kind of emerge out of the World Series. And it's, you know, I know that they're that Sandoval is not U.S. born, but so what? I
mean, no, this absolutely.
He's a stud. He's extremely likable. I mean, he's got one of the greatest nicknames in baseball and has embraced it himself too. Like, this should be the, like, if you're whatever, Wheaties or somebody, that's the guy you want on the cereal box.
Yeah.
And it should be. I hope it happens.
Well, and it's funny because we'll see, because obviously, or it seems like, we'll talk awards here in a few minutes, but
yeah,
it seems like Posey will probably win the MVP. Posey's got that All-American thing going. He looks like he's 11 and all that.
I know.
But
he's not that big. I remember the first time I shook his hand, I'm like, man, I thought you tower. I didn't say this, obviously. But it's like, not even height-wise, but he's not broad. You expect a catcher to come and sort of be like a bowling ball. And he's not. He's strong for his frame, but he's not a big framed guy.
No, and when he wears the hat, I don't know if the hat's two sizes too big or whatever, but it's like a Charlie Brown thing he's
right.
got going
for. You got your dad's hat on there.
Yeah. So he, you know, and he's awesome. Look, that's a likable team across the board.
Very.
It really is.
Very. Well, you know, they have generally scouted for makeup too. I mean, every team says that they do it, but some teams specifically say we don't care if they're bad makeup guys. We'll take Tampa Bay; they take all the bad makeup guys because, you know, a lot of times bad makeup is actually a product of situation, not a product of character.
Sure.
But the Giants, I mean, the big story of the Giants winning two World Series in 3 years is the draft. John Barr runs their drafts, and since he took over 6 years ago, I think. They've been extremely productive, especially with high picks from the college ranks and then finding some of these relief types, whether it's to keep or to trade, in some later rounds. But one thing that they just about all have in common is they've drafted a lot of really good makeup guys.
It's huge. It is so huge. You know, you when you look at this thing, and obviously this is what you do all the time anyway, but you don't have to hit on a high percentage in the draft in order to just be a great team. But if you do hit on a decently high percentage, you will be a great team. It really is incredible. That, to me, is the incredible thing about the draft. If you could get a good player out of every draft, you'd be a great team. I mean,
you're ahead of the game.
You're ahead of the game. And that's one player is all you're really looking for. You know, I mean, you'd love to get more, but you get one Buster Posey, that puts you ahead of the game in a big, big way.
Yeah. Oh, so it's funny you mention that, too, because I was talking to a scout the other day, and he pointed out, you know, the Cardinals are going to live off that 2009 draft of theirs for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And I went back and looked. I just pulled it up again to make sure I had it right. So Shelby Miller was the first pick at 19. He was, like, fourth on my board in that draft. I mean, he should have gone higher, but there was a money question.
Sure.
Joe Kelly was the third rounder. Ryan Jackson, who I thought should have been the shortstop on the postseason roster because he could catch the ball, was the fifth rounder. He's going to be a big leaguer for a long time. He might be Brendan Ryan, just a guy who never really hits but who can really catch and throw. Matt Carpenter was the 13th rounder.
Wow.
Trevor Rosenthal, who was largely a position player in junior college, was the 21st rounder. And Matt Adams, who may not have a role here but has 30-something home run power, was the 23rd rounder. That's one draft, and that's a lot of smaller school or, you know, somewhat under the radar guys. Or a guy like Joe Kelly who was Cal Poly, had one of the longest arm actions you're ever going to see. And a lot of he threw 100 in college, but a lot of teams said, nope, don't trust the arm action. He's either a reliever, he's going on the DL. The Cardinals took him, shortened him up just enough to what you see now where, yeah, he might be able to start. And at least if he's in the pen, you're not worried that any pitch is going to be his last.
Yeah. Well,
one draft.
Look, Trevor Rosenthal, that alone, you know, just getting a guy that's throwing that hard and that, you know, and you look at that team, sadly, as you and I have discussed on numerous occasions, right down I-70, you look at the Royals and they just can't get that kind of production out of a decade of drafts, you know?
No.
And I mean, we both know it's a wicked hard game, but you got to succeed in the draft. You just have to.
And those Royals, it's been all about pitching. I mean, they've tried to draft and develop pitching, and a lot of it's just gotten hurt.
Yes.
You know, and I can't tell you the cause. I can just tell you the results. Lamb got hurt. Duffy got hurt. If Montgomery's not hurt, he's just a lost cause at this point. Melville never did. I mean, they gave him a lot of money. Yes, he's out here in fall league, and he's not throwing well out here. And even I love Kyle Zimmer, the first round pick this year. Loved his arm. I mean, he's an athletic former position player who's an easy 92-97 with a good curveball. He's got bone chips in his elbow. I mean, it's just they're a little bit snake bit, but you also wonder, all right, is there a process? Like, why are all these guys getting hurt? Because they should be better than them. They should be – that's not even the right way to say it. They should be contributing. Some of that wave should already be contributing for them in the big leagues, and it hasn't happened for them. And that's why they are where they are.
And that's exactly right, because I think offensively they are moving at the pace that they should be moving.
Oh,
I mean,
yeah.
There are going to be setbacks, but that team is going to score runs. But
yeah.
The pitching is no further along than it was. I mean, assuming, no. You know, if Duffy comes back, but they're no further along than they were 3, 4, 5 years ago. And that's a real problem. I mean, that's a
huge
real problem.
I mean, if you add Myers, delete Francoeur maybe, and add Myers to right field, Hosmer's problem to me, it's where he's got his hands way up behind his back shoulder, too high, too tight. Get him back to where he was the previous season. That could be one of the top, I don't know, 4 offenses in the league next year. They're going to hit. They're going to have power. They'll be okay at getting on base. It's never exactly been a priority down there. But they're going to hit for average and power. There'll be enough going on, and they'll have no pitching.
Yes. Now that's exactly how it's laying out now, and that's just
That sucks.
It does.
Right? You just look at it, you're like, man, I feel for Royals fans, because it's – you're going to look at the team and say, well, you know, I want to go see the hitters hit. Can I just, you know, every half inning, I'm going to go get another beer.
Yeah. Well, at least you get to see the hitters hit. I mean, there have been plenty of years where neither half inning was going to be good.
That's true, right?
You're hoping for something. All right, so I want to ask you about this. So, and I'm writing about this now, and you and I have discussed it, and I know this is a big topic for you too. So the baseball playoffs is the way they're constructed now.
Yep.
It is utterly diminished the regular season.
Yes.
In a huge way, and that's a purposeful thing. I mean, that is what they've gone for. I mean, I don't think that it's been by mistake or whatever. That's the decision. The decision is, hey, we want to be a factor in October.
Yep.
The ratings are dreadful though, and I wonder. I mean, how much when you look at it? First of all, if you're running a team, do you have to build your team differently now because it is such an October game? And two. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's going to hurt baseball over the long haul?
So the second question is easy. Yes, you do have to build it differently. And I think you almost have to build a shadow roster. Like, you're building your team. You go into the season building your team for the regular season because you've got to get to the dance in the first place.
Yes.
But you've got to – one of the key things you've seen from the last several World Series winners and even pennant winners, this has largely been true, is they've gotten some kind of late season or October contribution from the farm system. We were just talking about Kelly and Rosenthal,
yes.
It was, you know, they went with Kozma, who wasn't what they thought he was going to be, but it could have been Jackson. You almost need to have your minor set up that you think by the time you get to Labor Day, you'll have 2 or 3 guys who could come up in September and maybe help with your postseason roster in situational roles, a bench guy, a backup infielder, an extra reliever. You can have Rosenthal rolling out of the pen throwing 99, 100.
Absolutely.
That's a hell of a thing to have coming out of your system. And you have to, as a GM, you want to go into a season when you're contending, knowing you have some kind of reinforcements to help in October, especially when you're going to construct the roster differently. You don't want to carry a 12-man pen in October, even though a lot of managers will. But you'd rather be able to add somebody to the bullpen who can get hitters on both sides out so you can only carry 6 relievers. Instead of carrying 7 or even 8 relievers.
Yes, I mean, we've seen this over the years. I mean, you talk about K-Rod. You talk about Adam Wainwright. You talk about David Price. I mean, these are all guys that eventually had a different role, but they came up one September and basically blew away October and got their team the World Series.
Yes. I mean, I think it increases the importance of the farm system too. And you hear a lot of complaints. This will come, I guarantee you, as we're heading into hot stove, there will be articles in December. Teams are overvaluing their prospects.
Right.
Signed, anonymous GM who's trying to trade for those prospects. I mean, that's exactly, it's complete self-interest here. Teams recognize that those prospects, they have financial value, right? Because that's just the structure of the game. Those first 3 years in the big leagues, it is all producer surplus. The team is just reaping all the value. But there's also this tactical aspect, too, of being able to, even if it's in July, you reach down, you grab a Neftali Feliz, and you've supplemented your bullpen for the last 80 games without having to go outside the organization. Absolutely. I mean, that's why a lot of teams just tell you, we just want, it's power arms. We're going to draft power arms. We're going to sign them in the Dominican, and we're just going to get as many in the system as we can and let them sort it out. I mean, I understand it doesn't sound like a strategy, but actually, if you get enough of them, enough will come through the sieve to the other side that you'll have your Rosenthals and your Kellys there to help you in October or in, whether even in August.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, I think that's a great point. I mean, I think that it has been really interesting. There's been so much talk, obviously, this offseason, I mean, this postseason, about Washington and what they did with Strasburg and all that. But it seems like the exact opposite is happening in a lot of different situations where you might keep a guy in the minor leagues for an extended period of time, let him just come up and totally blow it out for you in September and October. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, you know, so maybe I said it wrong in terms of the shadow roster. It's not about building a regular season roster and an October roster. It's a first half roster and a second half roster.
Yeah, there you go.
Thinking in the middle of the season, I'm going to go down and get the second wave. You know, you've got your casualties from the first half, and I'm going to go down and get the second wave. And if I have to go out to the trade market, I'll do that. But go into the season at least planning to get that wave of reinforcements from within rather than from without.
It does interest you. It find it interesting, or I do, that Washington did it the opposite way. I mean, that they basically used Strasburg. And obviously, we all know, I mean, the story's been repeated over and over. But yeah. They did use him basically as a first half pitcher and then sat him down. If they could have done it again, would they have done it differently, you think?
I don't know. You know, I wonder if for them simply getting to the postseason was the preeminent goal.
Yes.
That they would say, he got us there. That was the goal for us. And we believe we're good enough that we're gonna have additional chances to get there again where he'll be able to help us all the way through October. I don't know. I mean, I always thought that the public discussion on that was way too easy because, especially because there's so much, when you're dealing with a medical question, there's so much we don't know about what's actually going on with Strasburg, how he feels and what the elbow looks like and, you know, what his shoulder looks like, because you always worry about the guy sort of transferring some of the stress because he's trying to take it easy on the elbow. We have no idea. And Washington really has no obligation to give us all that information. That said, I think they could have probably pushed him a little bit harder or simply managed him differently over the summer once
that's
it became clear, right? They were going to get in, right? You could have backed off. I mean, because you're looking at it as we might need you to make two starts in October. That's
right.
It.
Well, that's
you could
what
probably
I
work that in.
That's what I wonder. I mean, I do wonder if at some point they could have made the adjustment where they said, okay, you're a once-a-week pitcher now until the end of
it. What was it? I was blank. The Reds had the Sunday starter.
Right, the Sunday starter, exactly.
Yes.
Exactly.
You know, could they have done that with Strasburg? You're only pitching at home the rest of the season.
Right. Right.
You know what? You could probably – maybe Strasburg's not the guy you want to experiment with.
Well, that's
I'd love to see some team do that. You can only pitch it – you know, we're – I was going to say San Diego, but they're moving the damn fences in. But, you know, like, we've got an extreme ballpark, you know, huge ballpark. You're a terrible flyball pitcher. You're only pitching at home this season. You know, why not? Why not go, if for some team that's got no money and they've got to experiment a little bit, why not try something like that?
I've always said this. I would always, when I was in Kansas City, I always wanted Kansas City to try crazy stuff.
Because yes.
Why not? I mean,
right. It's like,
the one thing you know for sure is if you go conventional, you lose. I mean, that's like the most obvious and clear story. All right. So you can't go conventional. So why not go wildly unconventional? Try all sorts of different things. Go with a 4-man rotation, or go with a a platoon at every position, or try things. And I'll tell you, there's just so much pressure. You know, you were in the game. There's just so much pressure in the game to not shake things up.
Conform.
Yeah,
to conform.
Absolutely.
Oh, no question. My whole thing was like, we're going to release these four pitchers. You're telling me none of them can throw a screwball, throw a knuckleball, throw a splitter. How about the splitter, the least experimental of any of these things? Hey, you know, just have the guy hold out his hand and see if it's big enough for him to get the ball between the index and the middle fingers. If he can do that and he's on top of it in his delivery, just have him throw 10 on the side and see if it moves.
Absolutely.
And if it doesn't move, you know what? Thanks anyway.
Yeah, why not? I mean, why not?
Nobody wants to do that. Oh, well, you know, the splitter blows guys' elbows out. He's going to be on a construction site in a week. But that's, and I'm not picking on anyone I worked with specifically. That mentality is pervasive in the industry. It's probably true in other industries too, but I can only speak to this one, that it's, there's too much risk. I don't want to get fired for doing that. Nobody's done that before. You got to expert. Houston should be experimenting all over the place. I mean, what they did this summer was basically they took a bunch of failed prospects back in return for some of their not terribly valuable big league assets. And why not? That's exactly what they should do. Somebody liked this guy 3 years ago out of the draft. He hasn't been very good since then. But maybe the reason that he was a first or second round pick is still present somewhere, and we can get it out. If we get five or six of those guys and turn one of them into an above average regular, that's a heck of a return for Chris Johnson, Wandy Rodriguez,
absolutely,
Brett Myers. Yeah.
Why not? I know. I totally agree. Okay, so then the second part of the question, though, is, and I'll just ask you from a personal perspective,
mm-hmm.
Do you like the game as much with it being so sort of, it's October based, it's short series based? Do you like the game as much, or do you like the game more when it's really built around 162 games?
The latter. I favor the more valuable regular season. I think that's always been, and baseball was kind of my first love as a sport anyway, and that goes back to my parents being diehard baseball fans, especially my mom. But also that I remember as a kid, the NHL at one point, I think, had 21 teams and 16 got into the playoffs. And even as a kid, I looked at that and said, well, that's just silly. And, you know, baseball was the opposite. There was a sort of a purism to it where, hey, if you get to the playoffs, back when it was four teams, and of course, even then, you know, it obviously used to be two teams, but for me, four teams was the de facto standard,
right,
that only four teams survived into October. That's pretty awesome, because if you got there, there was a pretty good chance you'd really, really earned it. Every once in a while, you get one of those fluky teams and a bad division slips through. But by and large, you were getting the best always playing in October, and it meant something. You had survived the grind. Now, I don't think four is actually the optimal number, but I think 10's too much.
Yeah, well, I just think, and look, and let's face it, you and I were pretty much on the same page on this, and you and I are also in a pretty strong minority. People love the playoffs, and they love the and look, you and I we're watching the games, we're loving them. I mean, it's, you know, they can't play enough baseball for us, but
right.
But it's not, it's just a completely changed to me the dynamic of what a great season is, you know.
Yep.
And you look at the way this season would have been if you had the teams with the four best records in there. Detroit and San Francisco are not in the World Series. They're not in the playoffs, you know, and that happens pretty often now. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's just a part of the game, and I'm not saying that's bad, but I preferred it the old way. I did prefer it where, to me, 162 games is enough. That's when you're going to find out how good a team is, not in a five-game series in October, weather affecting everything, injuries affecting everything, how your pitching staff happens to play out. I mean, it's fun in the way that March Madness is fun, but
right.
Baseball,
that's a good comp.
Yeah, baseball never really had that, though. That wasn't what baseball was.
And I think the new format is how you end up with an 88-win team with this massive defensive problem like Detroit, to say nothing of the back of their lineup, in the World Series.
Right.
And, you know, I mean, as much as they looked bad in four games, I think if Detroit and San Francisco were sort of facing off over, I don't know, 20 or 30 games, they weren't as far apart as the result of the series showed them to be. Yet, you looked at Detroit, I mean, I think even in the Yankees series, you sort of looked at Detroit and said, wow, is that really the best team in the American League? Might be the best October team in the American League, but it is not the best team in the American League. And, I mean, it's been pointed out, too, in the MVP debate where the Tigers actually won fewer games than the Angels did.
Yes.
And the Angels ended up out of the playoffs. Were they also behind Tampa Bay? I think they were.
Is that right? Yeah, well, Tampa Bay and the Angels were the two closest, absolutely.
Yep.
Yeah, it's definitely it's interesting. We'll talk about the MVP here because that is something people say all the time. You know, mm-hmm. and it's okay, well, Cabrera, you have to give him credit. He got his team to the playoffs, and Mike Trout didn't, and it's ridiculous. I mean, it's, but that is what baseball has become. It's like now getting in the playoffs is not only, you know, you don't have to be that good. It's so reliant on how good the teams around you are. It's just a very, it's very much, it's very random at this point. And I don't think the Tigers are a better team than the Angels. I think if they played 25 games, I think the Angels win that series. But Tigers get in because the White Sox collapsed and and were never really that good to begin with. And, you know, and so then here you go. And suddenly you're talking about, well, you got to put Miguel Cabrera, you know, he has to be your MVP, not only because he won the Triple Crown, but because his team made the playoffs. And that's that's where it gets kind of weird to me.
Oh, and why did Cabrera's team make the playoffs? They had three cupcakes in the division, right? The Twins and Indians were basically terrible, and the Royals we talked about. And especially, well, Cabrera was great in September because he beat the heck out of those pitching staffs, which included two of the worst in the American – the two worst in the American League, at least by ERA, whereas the Angels had the misfortune to play in a division with basically no terrible teams.
Right.
Seattle's unbalanced. They were not actually a terrible team, and there was a point in the middle of the season where they looked like they might be climbing back into the playoff race. And for Tampa, you could kind of say the same thing. And the two worst teams in the division, Toronto and Boston, were largely bad because they were not healthy, not because they were untalented. So to me, to look at Cabrera and say, well, he got his team to the postseason. Well, no, he happened to be in the right place at the right time. He did everything basically that he was physically capable of doing to help his team, but he didn't single-handedly get them to the postseason. Verlander did just as much. And it was a function entirely of context. This is why I have argued, I guess fairly stridently, that the argument that Cabrera's team reaching the postseason and Trout's team not reaching the postseason is an irrational argument is because it ignores that that's entirely a function of context. Trout's team won more games in a tougher division, and he faced tougher pitching, whereas Cabrera got to the playoffs basically because he played in the very weak AL Central this year.
And you want to talk about context. It's funny because last year, when there was the big argument about whether or not Verlander should be MVP, all you heard about was the same thing. He did it by himself. He took that Tigers team on his shoulders, and he Well, Miguel Cabrera was on that team.
And actually had a nice year, right?
He always has a great year. He's a great So, and then this year, it's like Verlander disappeared. Oh, Miguel Cabrera took that team on his shoulder. It's to me, that is where, and you know, and look, we both are on the same page on the MVP. We're both Trout guys. We both think he had the better year, the better all-around year, and so on. But that said, the thing that I don't like is Miguel Cabrera had a great year. And I wish the arguments for Miguel Cabrera were better. I wish the people that were making the Miguel Cabrera arguments were making the arguments based on, you know, the fact that he did this and did this and did this and did this, rather than these, like to me, these real ridiculous kind of scarecrow arguments where you just, there's nothing there. It's all straw. There's nothing behind it.
They're very narrative based that, well, Cabrera, you're crafting a story to fill in the gaps in his resume relative to Trout's. Because Trout's case is that he was almost as good as Cabrera on offense. It's actually much closer than people think.
Sure.
If you start to look at the context independent stats, Trout added more value on the bases, way more value on the bases, way more value on defense, and you got to consider Trout playing in a pitcher's park and facing tougher competition. So that's a huge advantage for Trout, and it shows up in the WAR stats. WAR is not the be-all and end-all by any means, but he destroyed the league. I mean, there's a reason that the gap was so large. So what Cabrera's supporters have had to do is craft these narratives. Well, Cabrera willed his team to the playoffs. He did it by himself. He played better when it mattered in September, which, as I pointed out, was basically because he was facing horrible competition almost the entire month, and he destroyed it, too. If you look at his splits by opponent, I mean, he beat the hell out of the bad teams, which is his job, but still, don't create this false narrative around him to try to justify it. You know, and to point to, well, Trout didn't get his team to the playoffs. Well, Trout's team didn't make the playoffs because they waited too long to call him up.
Absolutely.
From the moment he came up, he was the best player in the league. And if he had started the season on the opening day roster, they'd probably make the playoffs.
6-14 when he got called up. 6-14. They were as good as any team in baseball after he got called up.
Yes,
they were
better. That's your narrative.
They were better.
Why does that narrative get no traction?
Well,
and I don't like that narrative, but nobody wants to acknowledge that one.
Well, it's because the narrative of Mike Trout being the better player is so much easier to use. You know, you don't have to go to these other narratives, and that's what I mean. And that's what I mean about the Miguel Cabrera argument. Tell me Miguel Cabrera had an incredible year. Tell me that Miguel Cabrera led the league in total bases. Miguel Cabrera led the league in home runs. Miguel Cabrera, you know, led the league in this and that and the other. Make those arguments. Great, and then I'll make my arguments for Trout, and then we add them up at the end of the day. But when you start making arguments that are not only narrative based but are wrong, okay, you say, he led him to the playoffs, and you go, well, the Angels had a better record, and then you say, well, but he led him in September, and then you say, well, the Angels were better in September, and then you just at the end of the day, you just like, there's nothing really there in that in that argument. That's my feeling, and of course, nothing sort of. Makes me laugh more than the idea of like people ripping WAR and saying WAR is a horrible statistic. The guy won the triple crown. I mean, it's like your statistic is absurd. My statistic is perfect.
Yeah, and they fall on the argument from tradition too, which is that we've been using RBIs for 100 years.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, they used to bleed people with leeches, and eventually somebody said, "That's really stupid. Maybe we should try something better." Like, oh, hey, here's this bread mold.
Yes.
This might stop some bacteria for us. Let's try science. I mean, WAR is not science, but it is, it's more math. It's analytical. It has a rational grounding that can be taken apart, too. This was, when I wrote about this in late September, I didn't use WAR to make the case for Trout. I broke it down and tried to largely do it in non-mathematical language just to say, look, I want you to just follow me logically. If you come with me point by point, by the time you get to the end of the column, you're going to see the case for Trout. And hopefully I've convinced the reader by that point. But I stayed away from WAR, at least by name, instead walking through its underlying logic. Here's the idea of valuing each area where a player contributes and then trying to add those values together so that we have a single number that they can then be compared. You can point from Trout versus Cabrera, Trout versus Cano, Trout versus Verlander. I thought Verlander was just as valuable as Cabrera this year.
He had a tremendous year.
Yeah, really. It was just, unfortunately, he'll probably be remembered best for one bad start at the end, but he was tremendous through the first two rounds of the playoffs.
Oh, but much better than he was the last time around in the playoffs.
Exactly.
He was terrific. He was really, really terrific. You know, it's funny. Somebody pointed this out, and I thought this was pretty good. They were talking about how so many traditionalists on the MVP side will talk about the word valuable, the MVP. Valuable, I know. But that they won't talk about the word player. It's not the most valuable hitter. It's not most valuable, RBI guy. I mean, it's player, and I don't think even the most intensive Cabrera fan would argue that Cabrera was a better defender or was a better base runner or did so many of, he wasn't as versatile. I don't think anybody would argue that point. I think they would argue, and I think they should argue as Cabrera fans, that his total bases, his power numbers were just too overpowering, and Trout couldn't make up the difference. Make that argument. I'm fine with that. I don't agree with it, but that's an argument. But then you start talking about, Trout couldn't carry the team on enough of that stuff. You know.
And you know what? What that comes down to is another argument from tradition. Well, the MVP's always gone to the guy with the best offensive stats. Well, again, that's wrong. I mean, that is quite obviously wrong for the very reason you mentioned, the player, the word player. And the idea that defense and base running have no value, or that, you have gold gloves for defense. Well, those are a joke of their own, which is probably another hour-long discussion. But the MVP is, no matter how you parse its words, it's clearly about total value.
No question.
And I mean, and the arguments over the word valuable, it's like arguing with Bill Clinton, right? Over what the definition of the word is. Valuable means contributing the most value, independent of context.
Yes.
There's no, the rules do not specify one way or another about whether the player has to go to the playoffs. I think it actually says that he doesn't have to be on a playoff team. doesn't say that he has to be on a non-playoff team. But, you know, that, I mean, it leaves open some room for interpretation. But you really have to start some verbal gymnastics to get to the point where a player whose team does not make the playoffs is presumed to have contributed no value.
Yeah, it's ridiculous. I to me, and I've said this, I've written this, and I believe this, player of the year, MVP, mm-hmm. same thing. I don't see any difference. If you're the best player in baseball, you're the most valuable player in baseball. That's
right.
I don't argue. And of course, you make that point, and I've made this point as well. People will say, well, tradition, it's always gone to – the Triple Crown winner has not always won the MVP.
I mean, that's also true.
Ted Williams didn't win it twice. Lou Gehrig didn't win it when he won the Triple Crown. So, you know, all right, who's your NL MVP?
Posey. And you know what? If it were McCutcheon, I'd be fine with that too. I'd actually be fine with Braun, who has no shot in hell.
No.
Any of those three guys, I think, would be completely viable choices.
Very
McCutcheon
close.
Has no shot because the team stunk. And Posey, I think, won the narrative in the end. But it turned out he was good enough to win the award anyway.
I agree. Well, that's how I like
was
it.
Was he he's your pick too?
He Posey is my pick. And but I think McCutcheon is so close. I'm totally the same way. And this is how I feel about the MVP when it's like that. Any of those choices would be a good choice. I mean, I feel this way about Miguel Cabrera. He's historically, his season matches up. He had an MVP year. I think one guy had a quantifiably better season.
Exactly.
But he had a great year. It's an MVP year. What I don't like is when guys who did not really have MVP years win the MVP.
Yeah, the Juan Gonzalez.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. The George Bell when he won it. Dawson.
Yeah.
Won,
you know. Right.
But, you know, when those things happen, that's a little bit annoying. But any of those guys is good. Buster Posey had an incredible year. He did have an incredible second half. That team is fabulous. Perfectly fine with that pick. I think that's a good one. All right, American League Cy Young.
I thought Verlander, and it should be kind of a rout. And it was funny, when I threw that out there, a lot of David Price partisans were floored. Price had a great year, but Verlander, I thought, was head and shoulders above everybody else. The only guy who was really close to him was Felix, and Felix just kind of had a weaker finish to pull down his numbers. Not that I care about the finish, but just, you know, I thought it was easily Verlander and was surprised at some of the feedback I got from people making, you know, some rational and some irrational, but some sound arguments in favor of Price.
Well, I think Price is going to win it. And I voted in the American League Cy Young, so I can't give my pick away.
Okay.
But as I look at it, of course, and I say that winking and saying I totally agree with you. But I think Price is going to win it. And again, Price had a great year. I mean, it's not like Price is a bad pick, but I do think it really is a reflection of narrative in the case of Justin Verlander, where last year he was great, he was fabulous, but the year just got blown up into this mythical thing.
Right.
And then this year, he was almost as good.
I know.
And everybody just kind of ignored it. I mean, it was really, really interesting. Verlander, what a stud. Unbelievable pitcher he is.
Yeah. I mean, he's in that category of guys where, oh, he's pitching tonight? I'm going to the ballpark.
Absolutely. I mean, it's a small category.
I've been behind the plate for one of those outings where it was the 125th pitch or so. It was at Fenway a couple years ago before I moved. And it's funny, the scout in front of me reached down to grab his gun before I could get mine out, because from the situation, you knew the next pitch was going to hit 100.
Yes.
We wanted to see it on an actual radar gun, not the stadium, but on ours. And he did it twice. The guy, it was two strikes, so I don't remember if the next pitch was fouled off or if it was out of the zone. And then he came back and did it again to finish the outing. And, I mean, you could see even the hostile crowd reacting like, wow, that was amazing.
He is amazing. He is amazing. Yeah. All right, National League Cy Young.
That's a really tough one this year. I think it's R.A. Dickey, and I understand that the advanced metrics don't always love him because he's the knuckleballers sort of break the BABIP model.
Right.
But I do think Dickey is in the very short list of candidates. And if you sort of give him the boost saying that knuckleballers do have this unusual ability to limit balls in play, and he's got this incredible durability. I mean, the sheer innings he can provide add a lot of extra value, particularly for a club like the Mets that didn't have a lot of pitching depth to begin with. I mean, I think Kershaw would be a great choice. He was 14-9 and suffers, which doesn't matter to me, but matters to voters. And he suffers kind of from what you just described with Verlander, too, which is, well, he wasn't as good as he was last year.
Yes, exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. I actually am a Dickey guy, too. Love him. I think he had an incredible year. You know, look, we all know narratives get into these stories, and you know that's part of baseball too. Yeah. His narrative is fabulous, and he had a great, great year. Again, so close with several of those guys, you know, and Cueto and Gio Gonzalez and all these others. Kershaw is kind of the National League's version in that way of Verlander, I think. I mean, he's just excellent all the time. Yeah. And but he wasn't as good as last year. And so it really is the same thing. I think Dickey's going to win. I think he might win pretty big, but I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean, I think if I had that vote, I would vote for Ari Dickey.
I think Gio Gonzalez will get some support. He did lead the majors in wins,
yes.
Which, you know, the old school voters value. And he had a really good season. He doesn't have the narrative in his favor. And I do think some voters will say, look, he didn't even get to 200 innings.
Yes.
There is sort of a threshold there where that might actually be. I don't know that we've had a full season starting pitcher win the Cy Young Award with under 200 innings. I understand it seems a little arbitrary, but was Gio so good in his slightly smaller innings count that it should overcome the innings deficit? I think not, but I could understand somebody making the argument, well, he was extremely effective in when he did pitch, and putting him, I mean, he'd be on my ballot if I had that one. He just wouldn't be first.
What about the three people, I'm predicting this, three people who vote Craig Kimbrel number one? They pick Craig Kimbrel as their Cy Young winner.
Oh yeah, there's definitely going to be that. I mean, I'm just not putting a 70 inning reliever on my ballot ever.
Yeah.
Ever. I've been very clear about, well, look, if Tim Lincecum comes out, throws 120 innings with a 2 ERA, we're going to have a discussion.
Right.
That's going to be fascinating. But the current model of reliever cannot produce enough value. As good as Kimbrel and Aroldis were this year, and Kimbrel last year, too, they're like, you know, what are they worth? Three and a half wins? That's phenomenal for a reliever, and it's just good for a starter.
Yes.
That's the problem.
I think, you know, there's no... You know, there is, I guess, you know, the Raleigh Fingers Award or whatever, but they're just different jobs. They're just completely different jobs. That's why, I mean, I'm not opposed to the MVP going to a pitcher, but they're different jobs. They just are. And
it's hard to compare.
And it's hard to compare. Exactly.
Yeah. At least the starting pitcher, when you add up how many batters he faces over the course of a season, it's a number that you're in the ballpark, you're actually often more than the number of plate appearances that a position player gets over the course of a season. So your workloads are somewhat comparable. A good reliever faces a third or fewer of the hitters of a starting pitcher. That's the problem. You're making an argument entirely on context. Well, the value of the outs that he got was higher. I'm extremely uncomfortable with that, because then all of a sudden you start getting into things like, well, the team didn't have as many safe situations, the team wasn't, you know, the team was lousy. So was there value at all to his production? I hate that line of thinking.
I do too.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
So we're through our awards. We know who's the rookie of the year, so we don't need to worry about that. You're doing your free agent list. I mean, is this a... This is going to be a pretty wild offseason. Yes, no? What do you think? Yes.
I think so. I mean, here's my take. I've got a ranking. I'll do 50, and I'll do capsules on 50. I've written more past half of them already.
Okay.
The rankings, you know, they fluctuate as I continue to write about guys, and watch some guys drop off as their options are picked up and stuff. But my take right now is the top of the list is the worst that I've dealt with. But there's more depth. You get down into 26 to 50. I had more names than I had spots for, actually.
Wow.
There's depth. There's some back-end starting pitching depth. There's a lot of relievers I'd be interested on short deals. There's a bunch of position players where it's like, well, you know what? I'm not giving Lance Berkman $8 million for a one-year deal. But, man, if the knee checks out and he's willing to be a part-time DH, maybe play a couple games at first base, I got a platoon mate for him, that guy's really valuable. There's a lot of guys like that where a smart GM who's willing to, you know, fit together the different pieces could have some fun shopping in the bargain bin, essentially.
How much better can a team get on this free agent market?
I think a good GM with a little money and with the roster spots to play with, which is always an issue, especially, you know, a lot of good GMs are like, I don't have room on the 40, man. How am I going to kick a prospect off to sign a bench player?
Right.
Very few GMs want to do that at this point. But I do think a smart GM could pick up 4 or 5 wins in value without playing in the deep end of the pool. I mean, the Michael Bournes and the BJ Uptons and Zach Greinke to me is the obvious elite free agent.
Yes.
Every guy after him has some big question mark on him. And, you know, I mean, I've had some discussions with front office guys. Well, would you take Upton or Hamilton? Would you take Hamilton or Bourne? I mean, it's some of these are closer than you think. With Hamilton, the issues, it's almost entirely about playing time, even before you get into the off-field issues. If I gave you, if I told you right now, I'm giving you Hamilton for the next 5 years, what's your over-under on games played?
120 a year. You can't.
Yeah,
you can't
I was
go
just
going to
say, 600 would be a perfect line for the over-under. I totally agree. And if you think about it, if you're projecting Hamilton's performance, just statistically, if you used, you know, like Zips or one of those models, you know, giving Hamilton 120 games a year versus giving him 145 games a year, that's a huge gap in value you cannot make up. And you just don't know. You have no idea what you're going to get from Hamilton health-wise or, you know, the off-field questions. And I'm not even talking about makeup necessarily. It's like all that matters is how often does he show up for work ready to put on the uniform and get on the field. I'm with you. 120 is probably about right, and it might be more early. And by the end of the deal, he's a part-time player because his body won't allow him.
Well, his body has taken such a beating. I mean, it's, you know, I kind of agree in the sense of when I look at Hamilton – the off-field stuff, I mean, it's there, no question, but that doesn't scare me that much. It really doesn't. I mean, this is a guy that's been through hell. I mean, he's been through the worst of it. And okay, so he'll have it a couple of setbacks here and there. The guy is a pretty strong character. I don't fall for that. But the injuries are big. I mean, that's just the guy cannot stay healthy. He plays. He's a big body guy who plays really hard. Yeah. He takes a pounding. That's tough because I was going to ask you who in this free agent class is going to be the one that's going to get the big long-term contract that the team is going to regret. Who's going to be that guy?
He's the guy. He's the name that for me. And I agree with everything you just said about him as a player. But I think someone is going to pay him to be the MVP, to be the guy he was 2 years ago, and they're going to get 110 games a year or maybe even less. If you could get, and he's older than people realize. That's the other thing, because his career started so late. So I think we all tend to look at him and think he's like 28, right? No, B.J. Upton's 28,
right?
And Michael Bourne, I think, is 29. Michael Bourne might play at 30 next year. That age difference is also significant. I'm being coy about where I've ranked these three guys.
Oh, sure.
They're all up towards the top, but it's like these are things you really have to think of. Like if you look at my list when it comes out on Friday night. You know, your first reaction might be like, really? He put that guy over that other guy? Well, it's because of some of these other issues, and like age, like health, like position. Is Hamilton really a center fielder? Can you keep him healthy in center field?
I don't
know the answer to that. I have to just make an educated guess because that's the job. I don't know. But that would be a major concern for me. If I'm a GM and I'm thinking of signing Hamilton, I'm trying to figure out how I can get him to 130 games a year. Do I put him in left? Is he a DH 25 times a year? You know, am I just planning that he gets a game off a week just to try to keep him healthy? I don't know. I don't know that any of that actually keeps him healthy. But these are all factors, whereas some of these other guys, you know, the value of the guy who never misses a start.
Yes.
You know, there's something to that. What is Kyle Loesch? Is Kyle Loesch really as good as he was the last 2 years or so in St. Louis? Well, probably not, but he's pretty darn durable. There's value to that. There's value to Edwin Jackson's durability, even though he will make you insane because he looks like an ace and pitches like a four.
Except the days he pitches like a one. I mean, that's the thing that's...
Well, that's the thing.
That's the thing that's so crazy about him.
He is the classic. He'll go out and give up three runs in the first, and you want him out of the rotation. And then the next six innings, he's Walter Johnson.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It's really wild to watch him pitch. I mean, even in that playoff game, I mean, the first two innings of his playoff start, he was like, you know, it was softball. Anybody could hit him.
Right.
And then he didn't exactly tighten it up entirely, but he was a different pitcher from the third inning on. It's so strange with him. All right, so I have to ask you, ranking or no ranking, is the team going to be happy signing Zach Greinke to the big money?
I'm going to say yes.
Okay.
And I say that as somebody who usually, you know, I will argue every year, most of these contracts aren't going to work out.
Right.
I think Greinke's got... It's upside. It's free agent upside, not prospect upside. But I think Greinke's got some years ahead of him that are going to be close to that Cy Young season, where he's just, you know, he's almost put everything together in a single season two or three times now. And I think he's going to, that six-year contract he gets from someone, he's going to have two or three more seasons where he's even better than that. I'm optimistic. And I think he's one of those guys, the older he gets, the more experience he gets, the more that's going to be reflected in his pitching plan. He's a smart guy. with a real approach who still, you know, his stuff changes a little bit, and so he changes his approach. And, well, this didn't work last time, so I'm going to try it a little differently this time.
I'm with you. I'm totally with you. I mean, of course, I'm a Greinke guy, and yeah, happens from the start, but I'm totally with you. I think, look, and I have argued against almost every long-term free agent pitching signing because it's right, just it's just such a crapshoot. And I think you and I would both concede it doesn't have to work. It could completely flop. But
sure,
he just seems to me to be the kind of guy, like you were saying that about Hamilton. If I'm a GM with the need of a center fielder, I don't look at Josh Hamilton. That's
yeah,
if I'm a GM with the need of a guy who's a big power bat in the middle of the lineup, I could get him out in left. I could put him at DH. I could do those sorts of things. Maybe try to stretch him out. I see that. I see that possibility. But you're just asking for doom, in my opinion,
yeah,
by just asking by putting him in center field and hoping for the best. Greinke, it's different. If you sign Jack Greinke, I think you put him number one in your rotation. I think you're okay. I think you're in a position where that is good for him. And then, of course, if you put him on a really good team, I mean, if he was on a Washington or he was on a you know, San Francisco certainly, or one of these other teams where he was one of two or three ace type pitchers,
yep,
I think he is a guy that to me has a really good chance of being worth the money.
Yes, I agree. And there are not a lot of guys in this market because my ranking is independent of contract value because we don't know.
Sure.
And I'm just, hey, this is, I'm trying to give you my rough estimation of.
So you do it from best player on down. That's basically
on down.
What you
do. Yeah. And I'm looking not just at the current year too, but how many years is this, you know, a 36 year old player. I'm thinking, you know, just a year or two out.
Yes.
As opposed to thinking, you know, with Greinke or Hamilton or Upton, you got to think 5, 6, 7 years out. I mean, that's about the only accommodation I make for the market is that your horizons do differ some of these players.
But that is different. I mean, obviously you wouldn't compare them directly anyway, but you would compare 1 year of Lance Berkman, for instance, against 5 or 6 years of B.J. Upton.
I mean, Upton's got to be higher because you're getting 5 years of value.
Sure.
You know he's going to be good for 5 years, whereas Berkman could retire in June.
That's true.
You know, I mentioned him just because I happened to write up his capsule this morning and looking at him saying, well, there's value there, but extracting it, it's like shale oil at this point. There's a cost to extracting it. And you may end up with a dead roster spot because he hurts his knee again in April and he's on the DL for the rest of the year. And you've spent money and a roster spot in the offseason and are not now getting any return out of it. So, you know, that's reflective. Berkman's on the top 50, but he's lower down because of all of those variables there.
Okay, rankings are going up Friday on ESPN.
Yep.
Insider, I'm going to ask you, you'll probably just say you're not going to say, who is your favorite under-the-radar free agent in this thing?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's why I
yeah,
do this.
Yeah. Well, especially because when I do my write-ups, too, I start at the top, which is just like force of habit.
Sure.
But, you know, Iwakuma from Seattle.
Yes.
Pitched really well when they put him into the rotation. I understand the ballpark helped, but I think there's a place for him in more markets. I don't know what his willingness is to go to other markets, but certainly if I had a good outfield defense and or deep fences, I'd be looking at him. And, you know, guy who's he's in the 40s right now in my rankings, Casey Jansen from Toronto.
Yep.
You know, not a closer, not an ace ninth inning guy, but a guy who can really pitch. He's always had that going for him. And, I mean, he's been healthy for a while now after – get pretty significant shoulder injury a couple of years ago. He, on a 2-year deal, which is about the most I'd ever give any reliever, is a guy who throws a ton of strikes and really knows sort of, again, the art of getting hitters out. Yeah, that's a guy I would be targeting. If I was looking for bullpen help but didn't want to go do something stupid like give 4 years to a closer,
which
someone will do.
Someone will do. There's just no two ways about it. So
right.
Well, Keith, this has been great. I believe yeah, I've even recorded your voice this time, so that,
excellent,
that makes
excellent,
it even better. so I really appreciate it. Thanks a lot for being on.
Yeah, this was a ton of fun.